want to give a little bit of a plug for our online presence and publication. I think all of you are familiar with World News and Prophecy as the publication. It comes out 10 times a year by the church, and dealing with world news and prophecy. This magazine is what it says it is and what it deals with. We also have an online presence that some of you may not be as familiar with. WNPOnline.org is the web version of the magazine. And if you go there, you will see this page as the home page of the World News and Prophecy publication there, which is the online presence. And those of you that like to read things online, you can read the latest publication earlier than it will arrive in your mail, because usually the day we send it off to the printer, it's posted within 24 hours to the website. And in fact, the November issue is already there this week that went to the printer on Wednesday. So you can see the articles and read them. We also have a blog and podcast section where we have updated material as regularly as we can get to it, with additional information through the month that deals with various items that are in the news, and a podcast that you can download and listen on an MP3 player. Also, we have a section up here on the top. You'll see various places. We have the blog and the podcast archives. We also have a video archive. So all the seminars that we have conducted for the last year or so are on the web as well. And what we tape here today will, in the next few weeks, be posted to the site. So we have quite a collection already of different topics that we've covered within the last year at our seminars that you can watch with the streaming video off of the web as well as archives of the past publications. So it's a pretty good site. We're continuing to develop it. And I wanted to also mention, just down below here, you see this little yellow bar. We've just started it back in July, a biweekly newsletter that I send out every 2 weeks to a mailing list. It goes right to your inbox with a commentary on whatever may be taking place and links back to the website and to other of our publications as well that may pertain to some of the topics that we're talking about. You can sign up for that right there, and it will be delivered right to your mailbox every 2 weeks. So we're developing this site as a online presence for the publication to help keep up with a lot of that's taking place that just can't be dealt with in a monthly publication. So we're trying to be of service to the churches and to other interested listeners and readers of World News and Prophecy. So that will introduce you to that if you've not already been familiar with what we have on the web at WNPOnline.org. Let me go ahead then and get right into the subject. I would like for you to consider yourself as you are, which is a congregation of the Church of God. But I want you to put yourselves in the seat of some of those who have gone before us, our congregations of the Church of God that we read about in the book of Revelation. I think all of us are familiar with the book of Revelation and chapters 2 and 3 that discuss the message of Christ to the churches, to the seven churches that occupied a unique position there in Asia Minor. And the messages to those churches are fascinating. There are seven of them that are mentioned. And this particular presentation this morning is going to deal with what John said as the apostle who received that revelation from Christ and wrote it down as he saw it when he was exiled there on the island of Patmos. We're going to deal with that this morning in this particular presentation, the message that went especially to the church in the city of Pergamos. This is, you'll see the seven churches there in Asia Minor, Western Asia Minor, that we are familiar with, beginning with Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and then Laodicea. I think you all know that these churches were seven in number. They were on a mail route there in Asia Minor. And what John received in Revelation on the Isle of Patmos, just off the coast here in the ocean, he sent to these churches, and it is recorded there, of course, in the entire book of Revelation, but there were seven distinct messages to these seven congregations that take on a very interesting role when it comes to the development of the church throughout time, from the first century to our day. And the messages there, I think, are timeless to all of God's people, regardless of what particular point in time the people exist. All of us today can get gain understanding from all of these messages to these churches. So it's not necessarily just relegated to just one church or to one period of the church. We can learn from all of that is mentioned here. But there specifically was one congregation that I want to zero into this morning and the message to the church in the city of Pergamos in chapter 2 of Revelation, beginning in verse 12, where we read that to the angel of the church in Pergamos write, "These things says he who has the sharp, two-edged sword." And go on in verse 13, it says, "I know your works and where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. And you hold fast to my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days which Antipas, which was my faithful martyr, who was killed among you where Satan dwells." Now here in verse 13 of this letter to the church at Pergamos, it is mentioned that they dwell where Satan dwells. Now again, put yourself in the seat of a congregation receiving this letter. Keep in mind that the people in Pergamos were not a people that looked upon the letter that came to them that particular Sabbath that it was read to them from John, who they recognized as the leader of the church. This was not something that they were reading and saying, this is an interesting Bible passage. They really didn't even look at it as the Bible or necessarily inspired scripture the way we look at it today. Keep in mind that this was a fresh letter coming from the leader of the church, John. And he was telling them something that they needed to focus on for their immediate surroundings and circumstances. And he tells them here in verse 13 that you dwell where Satan's throne is. He tells them that twice in this one verse. You dwell where Satan dwells. Where you live is where Satan has a throne. Now that city of Pergamos would have given them things to think about. That message would have, as they left the congregation that day, they would have begun to wonder, what in the world was he talking about? I don't think they wondered too long as they would have left and walked the streets of their city and coming to an understanding of what he was referring to. In fact, they probably understood even as they sat there in the seats of their location. Let me take you to Pergamos, or at least the ruins of Pergamos here by virtue of these pictures here for a moment, just to help us get a little bit of a feel and a setting. This is a section of a large amphitheater, one of the largest amphitheaters from the ancient world that is in the city of Pergamos as it is today, at least the ruins of the city of Pergamos. There was a very large amphitheater there, and today if you go there, as some of our members did just a few weeks ago when we had the tour of these churches in Turkey by a number of members who were there, you will see and would see a city that no longer exists in the form that it did in the first century, but the ruins are there and quite prominent, the typical type of ruins that you would see from the first century period, the Roman world as they have survived, ruins of a partial colonnade of a temple that is there, and you can see the area around Pergamos has a number of hills. It's in a hilly region. This is remains of a street within Pergamos as it is. You would see it at this time. And this particular picture is a little larger view of the same amphitheater. And we have up here a drawn-in outline. I asked Scott Ashley, who was on that tour just a few weeks ago, to get some pictures to add to this presentation for me. And you will see the modern city spread out below this large acropolis, this large hill that goes up about 1,000 feet in the city where the ancient city stood. You had this large Roman amphitheater. And we're going to target and we're going to zero in on this little place here because in the time of the first century, this was the city. All of this really didn't exist at that time. The city was on this large hill with all the temples and the large Roman buildings and the amphitheater and this particular site right here, a couple of trees jutting up out of it right now, is a site we're kind of zero in on. This was the site of a large altar that stood in the city of Pergamos during the time when John wrote this letter to the church in Pergamos in the first century. There are three, looks like pine trees that grow up out of it at this point, but this gives you the configuration of a rather large altar that stood at that time. This is the platform of that altar, and it would have been looking out over the valley below from this very, very high position within the city. This is the platform, again, a little bit closer view of it, that where this large altar stood on the city of Pergamos. Pergamos had, as its realm at that time, a number of temples. There were two large temples that stood on this large hill. Both temples were dedicated to the chief deities of the ancient world, at least the Greek world, the god Zeus and the goddess Athena. Those were the top male and female deity. I think we're familiar with both of those names. They had large temples on top of the hill. And along with that was this third structure, which was an altar of Zeus, as it was called at that time, which was a large altar that stood there that was rather open, but had a number of colonnades. We're going to see some pictures of that in just a moment. But this occupied the city of Pergamos. Now, a few things quickly about the city of Pergamos that we should note and understand, just at least in the historical aspect of it. And it helps us to, again, understand what John wrote to the city or to the church about using a sword and where Satan dwells. Pergamos was within the region of Asia Minor at the first century. It was a Roman provincial capital. It was a seat of the Roman authority in the region at the time. That's why the sword is prominently mentioned there as Christ having the two-edged sword. They would have understood that symbol in terms of the Roman authority that was there. Pergamos was it was more than just a political position of authority in the Roman world at that time, but it was also a religious center. That's why you had these large temples that were there. In fact, there are some historians that record that after the fall of Babylon in 539 BC, many of the chief priests of the ancient Chaldean cults and religion there migrated west and relocated in the city of Pergamos. I use that term Pergamon. You'll understand why in just a moment, but understand I'm talking about the city of Pergamos. But these Chaldean priests, we're told, relocated in that area and set up at the time much of the Chaldean mystery religions that we read about from history that were so prominent within Babylon. But as Babylon began to recede in its prominence after the fall of the Babylonian Empire, migrations of people and religions and ideas took place, and a lot of that found its way into Pergamos. Pergamos built up as a city over the following centuries, and eventually they gave over their control to the Roman system and came under that control there. We're also told from history that the religious leaders of Pergamos even had as a title the title Pontifex Maximus, as part of their regalia, part of the titles of their official name. They were looked at as god kings in that way, in that particular area. And particularly in the second century BC, with the buildings that took place here, and what was this large altar, and the other temples there under a king by the name of Attalus, this region was built up during a period of time and became, again, just a center of religion and a center of political power for the Roman Empire that lasted as long as the empire itself lasted. And so when John wrote what he did to the church in Pergamos during the latter part of the first century, they would have quite well identified with the symbols of a sword, with the symbol and the terminology of the seat of power of where Satan himself dwelt. When they would have walked out of the church that day and thought about that, they could very well have walked by this large temple complex and this altar, and I think in that many of their minds understood completely what John was talking about when he said that you live where Satan dwells. You dwell where Satan dwells. Now let me mention one thing just at this point in my presentation so that we understand when John is talking about where Satan dwells. We understand Satan from the scriptures as a fallen spirit, a fallen angelic spirit, one of the covering cherubs, we are told from the book of Ezekiel, that once was at the throne of God, and he led a rebellion. We understand when we put all the scriptures together on that subject. But Satan is a spirit. And Satan, in that sense, is not relegated and confined to just one specific location on the earth. Satan can work and does work to this day in various locations and through as a prince of the power of the air. His spirit does permeate so much of the world then as it does now. So we don't necessarily look at one particular spot and location where Satan dwells, but John did use that designation here as under the inspiration of the Spirit of God. It is Christ's message. And he did have something in mind. And what he had in mind, we should understand, because it can help us understand how Satan works, the message to the church a little deeper, and its application for you and I today in our own world. To do that, let me take you to a modern location. This is a museum in the city of Berlin in Germany, the capital of Germany. This is the Pergamon Museum. You see the title right up here on top. When I say Pergamon, that's the German name for Pergamus. And so if I interpose the two while I'm talking, please understand what I'm saying. But this is the entrance to the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. I had the opportunity to make a trip there back in September before the feast. And Paul Kiefer, our minister in Germany, a resident senior minister there, took me into Berlin. We had 3 days, and one of the sites that I wanted to see was this museum, because within this museum, built almost especially for this one artifact, is the actual altar of Zeus from the ancient city of Pergamus that I showed you mound or the pedestal where that stood, and on the site from Pergamus. It was taken here about 100 years ago. In the late 1800s, the ancient city of Pergamus was being razed, and they were burning ancient bricks and buildings to gain limestone for modern building out of it. And the Germans, interested in archaeology and the biblical world in that period, wanted to gain something for their own use in Berlin or in Germany. And so they sent a team of archaeologists to the ancient city of Pergamus, and they brought back to the city of Berlin much of that ancient altar, and they constructed a whole museum around it. In fact, when you walk into this museum, the first room you walk into is a room that is many, many times higher and bigger than this room we're in right here, and it houses this particular altar, which you can see right here. This is the altar of Zeus from the city of Pergamus, as it exists now inside this museum in Berlin. You walk into this room and it just takes your breath away in one sense. This is the front facade of this particular temple. And people are walking around. You can get radio-controlled listening devices to help you explain what you're seeing as you walk around through this exhibit in the museum. Also within the museum is a part of the Ishtar Gate from the ancient city of Babylon, which is fascinating to see itself. But this is the centerpiece of the entire museum. And looking and understanding what this particular altar of Zeus shows us, I think will help us understand what John was referring to when he said that this is where Satan dwells. You dwell where Satan dwells, where Satan has his throne. When you understand what this altar was, some archaeologists feel that this was a place where sacrifices were burnt, animal sacrifices were given, and worship of the pagan deities of Athena and Zeus at that time. And would have been right kind of adjacent to the temples to those two deities, and served as a giant altar for that. But it's what was around the outside of that temple that is what we want to focus in on. I'll just show you a few different shots from various angles to show you the size of it, because people would walk up, and you can walk up those steps, and you would walk through this colonnade into a large open flat area where in the ancient time an altar would have existed, and the temple itself. And you would see just various aspects of it here, and standing up on top of it, you see how it looks as you're looking down, and had quite an angle. And keep in mind, you would be looking out over a large open valley scene from the top of this altar if you were there as it stood in the city of Pergamus in the ancient world. Now, this is a little scale model that is a part of an exhibit in that room that shows you where the altar would have stood. This is the altar as they have it in a scale model. This is the amphitheater I showed you the ruins of. This is one of the temples here. I think that's the temple to Zeus. This is the temple to Athena. And the top of this mountain, residential area, and then the altar itself stood right down here. This is how they have depicted the way it looks. And that's another view of it, with it open to the front. And then this is a second larger representation of it that you can look at in a glass enclosure there within the room. And you see along the outside of it are these a frieze of various depictions that we're going to look at very closely here of deities and gods and a great battle and titanic struggle that took place from the ancient world. This is a close-up of what we are looking at. Again, just to kind of show you how the entire temple would have been ringed by the scene that they put into it. This is a close-up, as it is in that museum today. Now, what this depicts is this. This is a large struggle from the myths of the ancient world, the ancient pagan world, of a struggle between two sets of gods and goddesses. Basically, as the pagan world defined it, good gods and bad gods. And the good gods are the ones represented by Zeus and Athena, Apollos, Hercules, who was half part human as well because he had a human mother, he was a son of Zeus by a human, and he figures interestingly into the story that goes along with this. But there was, according to their myth, this titanic struggle between a class of gods that were, according to their story, bad and evil, attempting to overthrow the other gods led by Zeus and Athena and the others. And what happened in this ensuing struggle was that Zeus and his set of gods won the battle. So they depicted this during this ancient scene on this temple. And this, you have to realize, is the basic story of the pagan antiquity, of to their explanation of their world as they viewed it, their world view. Now, we would look at that and understand from a different point of view. We have, obviously, from the Bible, a different perspective of how good and evil came into being and how this world operates. But this was their explanation. And it is a depiction of those whom they worshipped. The gods and goddesses. And you walk along and you see all of these various depictions here of this struggle that is taking place and the various poses and scenes within battle that is taking place here. This is a torso, a portion of a torso here, and another being that is dominating the one is on the ground. The way they depicted it, the good gods are beating the bad gods. Another way to look at this is it was a clash between the forces of chaos attempting to overthrow the forces of civilization, good versus evil, during that period of time, or at least again to explain their view of the world. This is another portion of it here that shows a female goddess defeating a bad god as he is on his knees here. And you'll see that this god here has a reptilian body. And this is very common in this this frieze that was around the altar of Zeus. This is another scene here, again, of a goddess, female goddess, and again, subjugating another god here is on his knees. And you'll see the head of a lion that has clamped down on a portion of the body at this point here in the particular story. And these are individual gods and goddesses, and they're all delineated as you go through here. Here's another scene of the struggle. You see a face here and a body, got his arms wrapped around the body, and you see the reptilian coil of the body. This is the bad god in essence, being defeated and dealt with here. Here's another close-up of one we saw with the lion clamping down on the body of the man. This is another scene here, another part of it. Hikati is the goddess here she's got a spear in her hand and she's thrown it at another god here who is again subjugated. You see the reptilian tail, and here's another lion's head that has got his jaws around the head of another god that is being thwarted here. This is a male god. You see this along the way. This is another picture of it showing much the same thing. And here's another, this is a female goddess here with her robes, and she's got the head of another god here. This is Athena that is being depicted. She's the chief female deity of their system. Here's another depiction. This is another lion, who's again clamping down on a body. Here's the head of a serpent right up here, and that down there. And This is a little dark in it here, but there's another serpent's head up here. That's a little close-up of that, so that'll give you some idea of what we're talking about here. Now, if we just pause for a moment, let's go back to the Bible. What are we told in the Bible when it comes to depictions of Satan? There are two symbols of Satan in the Scriptures that depict Satan. I think we should all know what they are. What are they? A serpent? A dragon serpent? What's the other one? A lion. Going about seeking whom he may devour is what Peter told us. On this altar, you see depicted quite prominently within this struggle that is taking place within civilization against chaos, the forces of good as they saw it against the forces of bad, you continually see these reptilian structures and features here and that of a lion taking part in this. As the members of the church at Pergamos would have heard this letter read to them on that Sabbath, as it came to them in their turn to hear the letter from John in the book of Revelation as we look at it, and he said, you dwell where Satan dwells. Could there have been any question in their mind what they might have thought about to understand what John was saying to them when they sat there or when they walked out of the church that day and went along their way? I don't think so. Other archaeologists and historians who have studied this as well and written on this subject see the point and the connection very clearly of John's statement about the throne of where Satan dwells and where Satan's throne is there as being depicted in their minds, in his mind's eye, by this altar of Zeus that stood within the temple or within the city of Pergamos. And they would have understood that very, very clearly. And looking at all of that in the history that we have, the connection with the book of Revelation, I personally don't think that there's any question in terms of what they may have thought and what John was thinking about when he wrote this particular portion under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit regarding this particular temple there at that time. And again, just to show you the additional scenes that you would see from the temple of Zeus, the altar of Zeus that now is in the Pergamon Museum there. Now, he said something also to them. Let's go back to chapter 2 and verse 14. He said, I have a few things against you because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. Thus you have also those who hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. Repent, or else I will come to you quickly, and I will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. And so we are told through this letter that there was a problem with a particular compromises that were being made by some to the point where they were being influenced by leftovers and at least modern for them in their day, a modern version of the ancient story and problem of Balaam and Balak from the Old Testament, where Balaam was taught how to trip up the Israelites by fornication, sexual immorality, and idolatry as they were coming along the road to the Promised Land, as we're told in that story back in the book of Numbers. They were taught how to trip up. Balak was taught how to trip up the children of Israel and to get them to compromise. John is saying to the church there, you've got a particular doctrine of those of the Nicolaitans, which was essentially the same idea of making compromise with idolatry and all of the type of worship that was there at that time. Part of the scene in Pergamos, as I mentioned, was that it was a seat of the Roman council, the Roman government. Prominent among that was the worship of the Roman emperor as a god during that time. This is a picture of the god of the emperor Trajan, which is also from the same museum there in Berlin, the Pergamon Museum. This is feature here. This is the head of the Emperor Trajan, who lived just a year or two or three, perhaps, after the book of Revelation was given to John. He followed Domitian. And Trajan, Domitian, at that point in time in the Roman Empire, the gods were worshipped, or the emperors were worshipped as gods. And part of that worship involved you had to make sacrifice with to the emperor, and to make some type of a sacrifice to prove your loyalty and fealty to the emperor. And so you have within this scene the members of the church wanting to be faithful to a different God, to a different king, Jesus Christ, having to fight this battle, and a literal battle that could have cost them their life. Remember, we are told there in chapter 2 that there was already a martyr, Antipas, likely a reference to the very first of the martyrs there in Pergamos, of a member who didn't give in, who did not give in to this cult, and was killed as a result. And so you had this challenge to the members that was ever present in their life of being forced to make a sacrifice to the emperor as a god to prove their loyalty, or to remain faithful to their newfound faith and religion that was coming under increasing attack at the time, and being faithful to God. And this is the issue that is here. And in John's mind, as it was within the mind of Paul, as he wrote to the churches at an earlier time, there could be no compromise. That those peoples were making sacrifices to a god Zeus, or a goddess Athena, or a god Apollo. And in Paul's mind, as he told them in 1 Corinthians 10, people who do such things are making sacrifice to demons. And so they would have understood by that time, it would have been very clear in their mind, that the depiction around that temple and of Zeus was a depiction of a titanic struggle of demons with different names. And that to be faithful to God, they could not have any part in that. And yet, at times, their life depended upon it. And this is the challenge that John is addressing to the church there at Pergamos, dealing with the cult of the emperor worship. And so again, there would have been no question in their minds as to what they were dealing with in that time and place. Now, we sometimes get into an academic exercise as we study these subjects from antiquity, the first century Roman world, and what they had to deal with in terms of their religion, and as they transferred it literally to an emperor. And we see the connection to the church here in the book of Revelation and the challenges that they had. And even as we read these letters to the churches in Revelation, chapters 2 and 3, and as we focus on the message to Pergamos, you know, it's easy for us to look at that as the ancient world and not see and the application to us in our modern times. But we do see, when we understand the connections through history, how the mind behind this, the mind of Satan, continues and has perpetuated in various forms these same ideas on into our modern world, and they are with us to this day. We look at, as John did, and he identified this system centered in Rome, the Roman Empire, as a part of this structure of the beast that was prophesied by the prophet Daniel, and the various, the larger beasts, Revelation 13, Revelation 17 went on to describe this, and various resurrections, as we understand it, even from that time down to our modern day. But we understand it as the beginning, if you will, or the Roman system was the unique period of the representation of that beast power, that it was going to have various revivals down through history, and one final revival prior to the return of Jesus Christ, which is yet ahead of us. As we look and peer down through history, we see this, and we understand that there's a connection between an emperor of that system from the first century, and later even, and what we see and what has happened with us in history today. We're all familiar with this individual, Adolf Hitler, from Germany in the Second World War. And to our time and in our place, he's kind of the representation of, evil and tyranny, and what he did and what he was allowed to do. It's a fascinating story that never really goes out of fashion in our time today. Since going to Germany in September, I've kind of been perusing through a number of books just to brush up on some of my understanding of the period of Nazi Germany in the 1930s, and Hitler's rise to power, and trying to, again, just understand that. And the number of books that are continue to come out to try to explain what happened in this person, what he led during World War II, still goes on. We can't get away from it. Some show I was watching recently mentioned that probably the Second World War is the most significant event in history outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It was a religious person talking, so they gave duty to Christ's resurrection. But they said that the Second World War probably had a larger impact on history than anything else. And there's an argument that can be made for that. We continue to be amazed by what that time brought upon the world. And he was right at the center of it. But we understand that that he is a continuation of that period from the time of Rome and the system of the beast, and we look yet for another revival. One of the things that I found that was interesting, and kind of after going to Berlin, seeing this altar, looking into its history, and studying again the connection with Germany, was something that was pointed out to me, and I've done a little bit of research to find. I want to just make a connection with you just for an interesting point here. This is a picture of a structure in the city of Nuremberg, Germany, southern Germany. This is a large outdoor conference area where Adolf Hitler in the 1930s and into the early 1940s would hold his annual party rallies for the National Socialist Party. The Nazis were a political party that came to power in 1932 in Germany. And so what we refer to as Nazi Germany, we have to understand, was a political party that came into being and seized power, and within a very short time seized and converted Germany into a dictatorship that led to the abuses of the late 1930s and ultimately the war and the Holocaust and all that came with it. But it was a political party. They held their annual political rallies in Nuremberg. Hitler had built in Nuremberg this large outdoor stadium. Part of it is still extant, but those of you that have seen some of the films and the pictures from that era have probably seen some of these, where there were hundreds of thousands of Nazi followers, troopers and members of the party would rally here, and they would hold their big torchlight parades and ceremonies. And this structure was built as a centerpiece for that. And this was the large reviewing stand where Hitler would stand right out here in the middle of it, and many of the officials would stand here and watch all the parading, and that would take place out in the center here. This is a picture of it here. This is a drawing. And what you're looking at is the model for this was taken from that altar of Zeus that was in the Berlin Museum. Albert Speer was Hitler's architect, and he designed the buildings of the Third Reich. And he designed this outdoor amphitheater, or theater, not an amphitheater, but this outdoor scene for Hitler's party in Nuremberg. And Speer wrote in his memoirs that he designed it after the Pergamon altar that at that time was already within the museum there in Berlin. And again, here's the model that we see from the model that is in the museum itself. This is the old altar of Zeus. You see the end facades here and all of the steps. So keep that in mind when you look at it. And this is as it stands in the actual model itself. But this is the scene with the Nazi rally. This is the reviewing stand back here. This is actually Hitler right down here. He's dedicating a memorial right there during one of the rallies. But this is what it looks like today. This is the ruins of it. It's still there. This is the middle section, and it was right up in here is where Hitler would stand. If any of you have ever seen the movie Triumph of the Will, it was a documentary of these rallies done by a German photographer named Leni Riefenstahl. And she shows one of the nighttime reviewing ceremonies here, and Hitler stood right out here in the center and reviewed the proceedings of his troops and his followers there. So if you go to Nuremberg today, you can see this. But what you're seeing, you know, I just found it an interesting connection that when Albert Speer, the architect, designed this for the National Socialist Party, he took his inspiration from the altar of Zeus, as it was in the museum there in Pergamon, and built this monument to the dream and the ideas of National Socialism, the Nazi movement, after that particular model. It's interesting how the same, you know, spirit inspires through architecture ideas and perpetuates those, and how they were manifested, especially during that time in the 30s and 40s, and the result upon the world was quite fascinating. So we have this hole that has a hold over our minds. historically. Many of you lived through those days. And the rest of us, in a sense, study it vicariously and try to understand. And in the church, we study it and try to understand not just for the past, but certain things that we might pick up as we look ahead and trying to understand how the same mind works to continue this a deception upon the world, and will one day inhabit a final political religious union that is going to astound the world, as we see from various places within the book of Revelation, that will involve the miracle working acts of a religious leader that will cause the world to wonder at a figure called the Beast, who will have the political power and for a short period of time create a situation that is ahead of us that will be a time of tribulation and trouble, as Christ said, such as the world has never seen. And he also mentioned, as Christ did in Matthew 24, that a deception that will take place that will deceive everyone, even if possible, the very elect. And so for those of us that are in God's church with a calling, with a unique revelation and understanding in our time and place, we've got to keep these things in mind as well. True, that period is only a brief window, if you will, in the whole plan of God. 3 years, 3.5 years, or whatever that time will eventually stretch out to be prior to Christ's return, known as the tribulation and all of those events. It is rather brief in comparison to the whole purpose and plan of God. But it is a passage through which this world must yet traverse before we get to the kingdom of God. And there are warnings from the scriptures for the church, for the world, to understand and to act upon. And so it is important, I think, for us to recognize in the totality the message to the church in the book of Revelation, and for us to make sure that we hear what is said to us. As verse 17 of Revelation 2 says, "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat, and I will give him a white stone, and on the stone a new name written which no one knows except him who receives it." And so that knowledge, that understanding is ours to have, to hold, to cling to, and to make sure that we never, ever compromise in our calling and in our life. If there's one thought that I can leave with you in this, never compromise. We will go out from this seminar, from this time and place here today. We go back into our lives, and we all have challenges. But perhaps at the heart of the message to the church at Pergamos, as well as to God's people at all times, is to not ever compromise. Never, never to compromise with idolatry, with false knowledge and false understanding, but to hold fast and firm to the clear, pure knowledge of revelation and truth that God has given to us. So that's what we endeavor to do with our publications, all of our publications in God's church, and especially as we focus in on world news and prophecy in this particular publication and this and all the other seminars that we conduct.